You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agadet. The FDA is meeting today to consider giving the COVID-19 vaccine to kids 5 and under. It's a day after they voted to authorize the Moderna shot for kids 6 and up. A new blood test could tell you if you're protected against COVID. And catching Omicron is not a good way to build your immune system against future infections. Coming up on our Doctor Roundtable today, Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of Idaho's Coronavirus Task Force. Hi, Dr. Pate.
Hi, Samantha.
And remember, if you have a question about COVID, send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Well, a lot of news out there about COVID today. Let's talk about vaccines for kids under 5. Now, I think we've had a question about this almost every week for I don't know how long. Mostly it's, are we going to have it yet? Are we going to have it yet? Are we going to have it yet? So it looks like it might happen. The Biden administration has 10 million doses ready to ship, according to CNN, and says vaccinations could start next week. Why is that significant, not just for parents and kids, but for the pandemic?
Yeah, Samantha, that's a really important question. So first of all, as you said, many parents have been waiting very impatiently for this. Myself, last year, I thought we were probably going to be having these vaccines approved or authorized, rather, at the very beginning of this year. And of course, the initial studies done by Pfizer showed that, you know, two shots wasn't enough. They needed to do three. And so it took longer, but here we are. And the FDA's committee, their special committee called VRBPAC that reviews the safety and efficacy of vaccines is meeting today. And so parents are very excited. I will be expecting that they will issue an emergency use authorization for these vaccines. What will happen if that is the case is that the CDC's committee, they're called ACIP, they will meet Friday and Saturday of this week. And then once they make a recommendation, the CDC director signs off on it, and then we're ready to go. So that could certainly happen, you know, Friday, Saturday, or Monday. But I do think by the beginning of next week, it is very likely that these vaccines will be authorized and then, as you said, ready to go and be distributed to the states. Now, to your question, why is this important? I think it's important that we recalibrate how we think about these things. So the most common thing that I will hear is, wait a second, kids are not likely to die. They are not likely to end up in the hospital. So why would we give them a vaccine? Well, first of all, if that's your framework for deciding on childhood vaccines, then there'd be a lot of vaccines that we currently give that you wouldn't give because COVID, for example, even though it causes much fewer hospitalizations and deaths in children than it does in older people, it's still more deaths than we would typically see in kids from flu or measles or a variety of other illnesses. So if you compare it to old people, yes, it looks like it's insignificant. If you compare it to other things that put kids or in the hospital or kill them, it's significant. But that's not the major reason. And that's why I think this discussion is so important. What we have to remember is we are still learning about the long-term effects of COVID in people who survive. So can kids get long COVID? Yes, they can. It appears to be that at a lower rate than adults, but they can. And frankly, we can't pick out ahead of time and say, okay, this kid is likely to get long COVID, but this kid is not. We don't have a way to determine that yet. Kids also can get a serious condition called MISC, or multi-inflammatory syndrome, that we've heard about over the, we've known about this for over a year now. And what happens is they recover from their COVID infection. And then within several months, they end up critically ill in the hospital. And what this is a, it appears to be an overreaction of their immune systems attacking their own body because of the COVID infection. Recently, people have probably heard about this so-called unexplained hepatitis in children. And we heard about these cases, especially affecting even younger among the children, often under 5 years old, and putting them in the hospital, and some of these kids having fulminant hepatitis and some requiring liver transplantation or even dying. And that's been very scary. Initially, there was a lot of theories put forth that this was being caused by adenovirus 41, which frankly has never done this before. Now, doesn't mean it couldn't be, but it certainly seemed peculiar to many of us to blame it on that. But more recent studies have raised significantly the likelihood that this hepatitis in these young children is looking more and more likely like this is an after effect of COVID. And so the point is, we don't know all of the long-term effects. So that's one reason to vaccinate kids. The other, another important reason to vaccinate children is, Samantha, as we've been talking about the last 2 years, if we want to stop the development of all these new variants, and this virus is developing new mutations at a faster rate today than back in 2020. And if we want to stop that, we have to decrease transmission. And children are now an important part of that transmission chain. So that's another reason. And then one more reason, and I'll stop. But another reason to do this is many families which have young children in them also have a grandparent or have a parent with an autoimmune disease or with a cancer that they're getting treated for or other reasons that they are immunocompromised. And so vaccinating children is another way of protecting those others that are in the household.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So what about this new blood test that we're hearing about? NBC is reporting it can help you figure out if you have protection against catching the virus. And that could be critical for some of the people you're talking about who may have pre-existing conditions. Does it work? Are we going to see it soon? Should we use it?
Yes and no.
Good.
I'm very excited about this, but this is not going to be a panacea. So, go back to 2020. You may remember that I was very outspoken against, people were saying, well, get an antibody test and then you can see if whether that cold or whatever you had was really COVID, and you can see whether it's safe for you to go back to work. And I kept on saying, whoa, whoa, whoa. First of all, there's more to the immune response than antibodies. And we cannot assume because people have antibodies that they're necessarily protected, because there's two other parts of the immune system that antibodies don't measure. So what you're talking about now is a test that would actually check to see, are your T cells activated against the SARS virus? And, that's exciting because that is another part of the response. So we talked about antibodies. Another part is called cellular immunity. cellular immunity is broader than just T cells, but T cells are an important part. And what this test would do is tell you if your T cells recognize the SARS protein, which they won't if you've never been exposed to it. And if they do, then that could be a very helpful sign about possibly what your protection is against COVID. Now, what it's not is an indication of whether you might get infected, whether you're protected from getting infected, because that is going to be much more dependent on the antibodies than your cellular immune system. What this would be a test about is, are you likely protected from getting, if you do get infected, from getting severely ill or dying or being in the hospital? So I'm not sure how practical it would be, because these tests are usually expensive. They're usually time-consuming, difficult to get done. What's exciting about this is it appears to be that they have figured out a way to make this test far more affordable. You know, perhaps at its wholesale cost, it might be on the order of $50. I suspect, you know, if it goes to market, you know, we may be talking $100+, but still much less than what we would typically spend to get that kind of testing. So I don't think it will be the panacea, but it could certainly provide some additional tests. It could be helpful. For example, Samantha, we often get the question, should I get a booster now or should I wait to the fall? This might be one way to help answer that question. Another one could be helping us to tell, you know, if we do need that booster or another booster. So I'm excited. I think it's way too early to put this to use, to know exactly how to use it. It's not going to be, again, a panacea, but all the time, the more information we get, the better.
Absolutely. So Dr. Pate, I wanted to talk a little bit about positive and negative COVID tests, and I want to start with negative. There's an article in The Atlantic titled, "A Negative COVID Test Has Never Been So Meaningless." And I think a lot of people are running into this. So a couple of weeks ago, we heard from a woman, her spouse caught COVID, but she kept testing negative despite living in the same house. She went to work and 2 days later came down with COVID. So why did she keep testing negative? What is the article talking about?
Yeah, so this is a common situation that we deal with, and we've known about this for a while. It seems to be more of an issue with Omicron than with the previous variants that we dealt with. Not entirely sure why that is, but I have, and in fact, we've talked about this on the show before, that I've suggested to some people, hey, if you're sick, if you're not feeling well, stay home. And even if you have a negative test, just stay home. First of all, it's, you know, it's not a good idea to go to work sick regardless, because still, even if it's not COVID, you know, most people will not be interested in getting your influenza or parainfluenza or whatever virus you happen to have. So it's a good idea to stay home. I have been telling people, don't even test when you first get the symptoms. You know, the big thing for most of the people that I advise, most of them are going to be candidates for Paxlovid, the antiviral. And the window for getting that is 3 to 5 days. Usually we will see most people turn positive on their rapid tests, these home tests, the ones that if you ordered from the government and they mailed them to you, these are the kind of tests we're talking about. Most people will turn positive by day 3, not everyone. And so what I do is, because we want to give Paxlovid during that time, is I tell them, don't even test the first 2 days. Just start, you know, stay home, rest, and then day 3, test. If it's positive, let me know. Let's get you started on Paxlovid. If it's still negative, test again days 4 and 5. That's our window for the Paxlovid. Other thing that we learned is that the PCR test, that test that you go to the pharmacy or your doctor or the hospital for, that they take that swab and then they send it off to a lab, and it typically takes a day for you to get the results. That one, will often turn positive about a day before your rapid test will. And what we see, Samantha, is varying responses. We see people that have been fully vaccinated and particularly boosted, they may turn positive a little bit later than somebody that's not vaccinated. That's not in every case, but that is kind of a general pattern that they may not turn positive till later. And so whether you turn positive, a lot has to do with what is the level of virus in your nose where it's being sampled. And of course, the other thing we always have to consider when somebody has a negative test, but they're sick, is did you do the test right? And so it's very important if you're doing a home test, make sure you follow those instructions. The big thing is make sure that when you're reading that test that you see a control line. It's the C on the test strip, and there should be a line there to tell you that the test is working.
Well, the article says basically that, if you're sick and you get a negative COVID test, that's not a free pass to go out and mingle just because you don't have COVID. I think I read there's something like 8 different viruses or things floating around right now that aren't COVID that you can have that'll make you sick or feel sick. And I think what you said is very apt. I mean, other viruses can hurt and even kill people. Flu kills a lot of people every year.
Well, that's right. And we just need to change our mindset. I remember, back when I was a resident in training, if I didn't come to work, that meant somebody else was going to have a whole lot of work. And it was kind of a badge of honor to come to work sick because it showed how tough you were. But it was really ridiculous that we were doing that because we were taking care of patients. And for heaven's sake, we shouldn't be taking a risk of getting them sick. So, even the medical field has been guilty of this. But I think this pandemic is a wake-up call to tell us, look, if you have symptoms, if you're not feeling well, please just do everybody a favor and stay home. A negative COVID test may mean that you don't have COVID, or it may mean it's just too early. And so, as you say, Samantha, even if it's not COVID, most people are not going to be happy to have whatever it is you have. So why don't you just stay home and be miserable without making the rest of the office miserable? That's how we need to really change things, I think.
All right, so let's go over to positive. Sue had a question about positive tests. She says, what should you do if you had COVID, got over it, don't have any symptoms, but you keep testing positive? So opposite problem.
Yeah, great question. Okay, so again, here's going to be important for us to differentiate which kind of test are we talking about. So remember, PCR test, that's the one you go to the doctor, hospital, pharmacy, they take the test, send it off to a lab, you get the results back the next day or 2 days. That test, if you get that test and it's positive, don't do it again. It's not going to tell us anything if it's positive, because that test is picking up genetic material of the virus. So even once you get infected, your body is going to attack that virus and hopefully kill that virus, but it's going to leave on that battlefield of your nose a lot of genetic debris. So that test can remain positive. So do it once, do not repeat that again. Now, what your listener's referring to, I'm sure, is the other test. Now we're talking about the rapid test, the antigen test, that test. Sometimes it's called a lateral flow test. It's the test that you can order from the government that they send you the free test. That's the one we're talking about that you do at home. So what I suggest to people is, again, as I mentioned, you get symptoms, just wait a couple days. Stay home, rest, get caught up on your emails or the book that you want to read, whatever. Stay home and rest. Then start testing about day 3. And maybe test days 3, 4, and 5. There's a reason those test kits generally come with 2 tests in them. And it's because we have always realized, that if the first one's negative, you probably ought to do another one in the next day or 2 days just to be sure. Mm-hmm. Now, once that's positive, Now stop testing. Give it a little bit of time. And what we say is that if you, from the time you get your symptoms, you need to isolate at least 5 days. That means stay home, away from people. You don't get around other people 5 days. Now, that's not to mean that at the end of the 5 days that you're no longer contagious. That will be the case for a fair number of people, that they probably are not going to be infectious after that. But there are other people that do remain infectious for a number of days following that initial 5 days. That's why the CDC says, even after that 5 days, you need to mask for the next five, for a total of 10 days, because some people will still be contagious. Now, so others have tried to figure out, well, how can I tell if I'm contagious? There is a way for us to tell, but again, it's a very specialized, very expensive, very time-consuming test, so it's not really practical. What a lot of people use as a substitute is now doing those rapid antigen tests again, those ones, those the home tests. It's not a perfect correlation, but it if you are in a situation where your decision about whether you're going to stop isolating now at, let's say you wait the full 10 days, but you're worried because, hey, I work with somebody who's pregnant, or I work with somebody who's immunocompromised, or, you know, I have somebody in my family. What a lot of people will do is then after that initial 10 days, you could start doing those rapid antigen tests again. And the rule of thumb would be if they're positive, assume that you're infectious. That may not in reality be true, but we don't have any other better practical way. And so if it's positive, then you can keep testing until it becomes negative, at which time now you can pretty much assume you're not contagious. The other twist in this.
There's another twist.
There's another twist. This is not easy. And that is the people that take Paxlovid, that drug I mentioned to you that is the antiviral. We are seeing in a not insignificant number of people that they take the Paxlovid. That's a 5-day course. They take it. And then after that, they become negative while they're taking it. But then after they finish the Paxlovid, they become positive again. So what that doesn't mean is that the person who's testing positive is going to get sick or sicker. That's not what it means. But the question is, has that antiviral suppressed the viral replication for a while, but now you have a kind of a rebound, and could you infect someone else? Don't know the answer to that question. That's being studied right now. What we do recommend is that if you have that rebound and you're testing positive, just keep masking and be careful not to be around high-risk people. So there's a very complicated answer to what you probably thought was a simple question.
Okay, good. Dr. Pate, this question has come up off and on, and I think there's a lot of confusion about it. Steve writes in that my wife and I tested positive for COVID-19 3 weeks ago. We were both immunized with the first booster, but not the second booster, and they're both over 55. So their question is, when do they get the second booster? Basically, how long after testing positive for COVID should they wait to get the second booster? Is there a recommended time?
Yeah. And so, and that recommendation has changed from what it was initially from the CDC. Now, what the recommendation is just once you feel recovered, and by that we mean, you know, have your symptoms gone away. So once you feel like you're over the COVID infection, perfectly fine to go ahead and get vaccinated. The question I thought you were going to ask me is, because they got infected, does that mean they don't need the booster? And I would just tell all your listeners, anybody whose infection has been Omicron. So we're talking about basically if you got infected this year. All the studies that are coming in are showing us that Omicron is not good at stimulating an immune response, and that you're not going to have much, if any, protection from just that natural infection, natural immunity. So for the listeners, their specific question is, if they're feeling fine now, they can go ahead and get that second booster and probably should. But for anybody that's relying on an infection this year, please don't. Please get vaccinated, because that infection is not going to protect you like previous infections did.
And that, I think, is very important, because, you know, we've heard from people who've said, well, you know, I got Omicron, pretty sure I got Omicron, and I should be safe now, right? And we're seeing a lot of information, especially out in articles. We'll put a link to one on our website that says no.
Yeah, well, that's right. And in fact, we can look just to the Prime Minister of Canada and our Secretary of Health and Human Services. He got infected last month, so that would have been Omicron. He's just gotten infected again. And that's what we're seeing, is that the Omicron infection is not protecting people. And therefore, what we're seeing is a lot of reinfections. And that is likely to be the same story when BA4 and BA5 cause our next surge. There's more evidence that it is even less protective against BA4 and BA5. And so, you know, I know people are thinking COVID's no big deal. I would just caution people, look, you know, don't wrap yourself up in a bubble, but still take precautions. We don't know the long-term consequences of COVID infection, and we don't know what kinds of problems reinfections may cause for people. You'll hear people say reinfections are going to be mild. They are for some, they are not for others. And we are mounting some more evidence that makes us have some concern that you probably don't want to be in that reinfection group.
Absolutely. And since, as you said earlier, you know, you never know who's a candidate for a mild infection or a not mild infection. Do you really want to roll the dice? Probably
precisely.
Not.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Precisely.
Okay. So I want to go back to the FDA meeting today about kids getting vaccines who are 5 and under. In the article from CNN that we referenced, CNN also cites a study that says only 18% of parents will get their kids under 5 vaccinated right away once it's okay to do so and the vaccine starts rolling out for that. Can we talk a little bit about only 18% of parents want to get their kids vaccinated right away? I'm pulling out your soapbox for you.
Well, thank you, Samantha. Yeah, you know, I get it. You know, the problem is that there is so much misinformation and disinformation out there. You know, in fact, we've heard from the physician on Central District Health Board that, you know, his position, which I think is absolutely absurd, is that absolutely no child should get vaccinated. And then, you know, he comes up with all these ridiculous explanations about why. Now, you know, the thing is, I read the studies. I am a doctor. I can tell for myself, and I can tell that it's baloney. But, you know, what is a parent to do? And of course, this is going to be scary when you hear people giving out that kind of information that, oh my God, I don't want to hurt my kid. And of course, nobody wants to hurt their kids, and no one loves their kids or grandkids more than I do. And yet all of my kids that can be vaccinated are vaccinated. And I got vaccinated as soon as I could. My kids did, and my grandkids did. I've got one grandkid who will be in this new group that's under five. So, and what we're going to do is as soon as that's authorized, probably next week, he'll be over for his vaccination. I understand parents are going to be concerned about this, but let me tell you, we already, from all the children around the world that have been vaccinated and that are in these older groups, we already have tremendous experience with this vaccine. We know that it's safe. Does safe mean that there cannot be an instance where somebody has a reaction or a problem from the vaccine? Of course not. There is nothing safe. Even if you're taking Tylenol, I can't tell you that that's going to be safe in everyone. And so everything that we put in our bodies obviously has some risk. So what we have to do is we have to weigh risks. And so it's not the risk of getting a vaccine or not getting a vaccine. It's a risk of, do I take the risks associated with the vaccine versus the risks associated with COVID? And I'm sure we don't have time to get into that right now, but let me tell you, any risk that you are going to tell me about that you're worried about with the vaccine, it's manyfold greater with COVID. And so probably the most notable concern that I'll hear about the vaccine is myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle. Does that happen with the vaccine? Yes, it does. Does it, is that a reason not to get vaccinated? No. That is typically boys and men, 16 to 29, happens at a rate of about 1 in 20,000, and it's mild, and typically they're over it in a day or two, and many won't even realize that they have it. What about COVID? If you look at the rate of myocarditis for COVID, it's about 20 times more likely. And unlike the vaccine, the COVID-caused myocarditis, which, like I said, occurs much more commonly, is usually serious and usually causes problems and can even cause death. So again, when we weigh, do I vaccinate or not, it's not it's not just, do I accept just these small risks with the vaccine versus not taking any risk? No, the risk is, do I accept these small risks with the vaccine versus the much greater risks with COVID?
Indeed. And I think that, would it be good advice to tell folks who have kids five and under the vaccine is given authorization and they're still not sure, who should they turn to? Pediatrician? Is that a good place to go?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and of course, you know, an embarrassment to me of my profession is that there are some doctors who are, you know, not keeping up or are promoting falsehoods. Not many, but there are some. So you need to have a reputable physician. But yes, check with your pediatrician. And certainly you can submit questions to this show. I'm happy to try to answer them. There's lots of resources that you can use, but talk to your doctor and understand that myocarditis risk that we just talked about, we don't see it in this age group below five. We just don't see that with the vaccine. It's older kids. So that's not going to be a reason not to get vaccinated. I just encourage you, if you have questions, talk to your doctor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. We've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to ask you, what are you concerned about this summer? If you were to pick one thing involving COVID, what are you worried about?
Well, I'm worried that there are so many people who have pronounced COVID as being seasonal, which it is not, that people will think, okay, I don't have to worry during the summer. And of course, we've already let our guards down. You know, we're not wearing masks. We're not avoiding large groups. And on the other hand, what we are seeing is BA4 and BA5 that are another sublineage of Omicron, which have the greatest amount of immune escape to date, meaning that any protection that you have from a prior infection is going to be far less against these, if any. And even the protection from vaccines is reduced. It probably is still very protective against getting severely ill if you're vaccinated, but you're going to have a greater chance of getting infected. And so I think people are not paying attention. I think people don't realize that these variants, BA4 and BA5, these are the most contagious ones we've seen and have the most amount of immune escape. And they are rising in our part of the country right here. We have the second highest percentage of BA5. It's about 19% of our specimens in this. And I'm talking about Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Wow. And we have about 5% of the BA4. So they're in low levels. And as we've seen before, we typically don't see these playing out until they get over 30, 40% or so. So I think what's happening is people are going to think, well, this Omicron surge is over. To be surprised that we may very well have another surge by BA4 and BA5. And it may be this summer when people are thinking, oh, we won't have COVID because it's seasonal.
Okay. We've been speaking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force. If you have a COVID-19 question for the Dr. Roundtable, send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu, and we'll ask it next week. Dr. Pate, thank you always for helping us navigate through the continuing quagmire of news and updates of COVID-19.
My pleasure, Samantha. Thank you.
I'm Samantha Wright, filling in for Jim Agudat on Idaho Matters.